Hey, we're on, I think. Can you hear me?
Sure.
All right. Hi. You all, I assume, got the email postponing the due date for the assignment that was supposedly due today, and postponing that till a week from today, and that's okay. Well, you know, you change the syllabus, you might upset people. You can still do it early. Don't wait until next Tuesday night to finish it. But I did want to talk about it, and one of the reasons we postponed it was that we hadn't talked about it since before break, and that discussion was rather brief. So I wanted to make sure that we were clear about what we were expecting, and we'll try. The first thing we need to start with is the notion of a principle. Since this assignment number 5, requests that you create a set of principles for a developmentally facilitating ecosystem using Bronfenbrenner's framework. So some people have some confusion about what a principle is. A principle is a rule, a standard, something like the principle of least effort, or, quick, give me another principle. Sorry, should have warned you about that. The principle in employment practices of last in, first out. Last one hired is the first one to be fired, first one to leave. So there are general rules about how things operate. Principle is a general rule, and it tells you how things operate, and in some cases, how it should operate. So it's a rule or standard, especially of good behavior. And in this particular case, what we're interested in is the principles that would govern a developmentally facilitating ecosystem. So the original assignment, which you have in your syllabus, is to sort out from Bronfenbrenner's framework a clear statement of your understanding of what conditions of the ecosystem are most supportive of human development. This will require that you study the hypotheses pertinent to each element of the system, microsystem, relation, mesosystem, exosystem, and try to abstract the important features and then synthesize them into a set of principles that express how an ideal system would operate. I've restated that perhaps more simply, and this is an additional instruction or alternative. It's the same assignment, but using the Bronfenbrennerian framework that you have, write a set of developmentological principles that capture and synthesize all the features of an ecosystem that would facilitate development ideally. Okay, so you get to just write the rules. Make a poster for yourself. Just write the 5, 10, 15, 75, whatever you think the principles are, how many you think there are, and try to put them in as clear a statement as you possibly can. Think clear, concise, and simple. It should take you 2 or 3 pages. You don't need to elaborate. You don't need to cite hypotheses or definitions. This is your opportunity to bring it all down to clear principles that you can hang on to and put on your refrigerator for the rest of your life. Or, if you're going to take HDFS 161 next fall, that you can bring in with you the first day and apply through the rest of the semester. We might elaborate on them a little bit. The maximum points possible are 25. It's due next Wednesday. And it says optional. The point is that this assignment is not required. That is, I'm not going to throw you out of the class if you don't do it. I'm not even going to chase you around if you don't do it. But if you don't do it, you don't get any points, and the people who do it do get points, and therefore they get a higher grade than you do. But Julie checked last year's distribution to be sure. She checked it yesterday. And last year there were people who did not do this exercise with the same point system as this year, and they did get A's in the course. So somebody had asked that specific question. So it is possible to do well in the course if you do well on everything else without doing this assignment, for those of you who are trying to lighten your load over the next week. Bullets would work. Make sure they're clear. Yeah. Right? Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to do this in two or three pages, you know, you're not going to write big elaborations of them. Just make sure you cover the whole ecosystem. Relations should be characterized by... Actually, instead of answering that question, I should ask everybody to write one. Right? What am I doing? Giving you the answers. Huh. It's not fair. Relations should be characterized by a high degree of reciprocity. Say that again.
The elements of Bronson Brennan's framework take certain ones that you feel are most important to being developed fully.
You might want to emphasize, the question is, should you take the ones that you think are most important? Yes, but make sure you cover the whole ecosystem. So don't focus on relations and forget about the exosystem. Okay. Make sure you cover the whole system and all of its elements. Its elements are dyads, molar activities, microsystems, settings, mesosystem, exosystem, macrosystem. So make sure you're thinking about the entire system as you do this. It should be general in the way that Bronfenbrenner is general and applies to everybody. Not what you're looking for in your specific relations, but I mean, you can think about that obviously, but state it more generally. Yes. Are we moving back the date for assignment 6 as well? I have no idea. But thank you for asking the question. Julie will come up with an answer by Monday. I haven't thought about the calendar yet. It's not due next Wednesday, is it?
No.
Yeah. Then we have time to think about it. It sort of depends on how many other things we have coming in. But thank you for thinking ahead. The question is, are you restating Bronfenbrenner's hypotheses, the ones that you think are most important? Restating in the sense that you are distilling them into what the general principles that underlie them are. And you don't need to refer to specific ones. There are a whole bunch of them that refer to the mesosystem. And if you go through all of those hypotheses about the mesosystem, there are several sort of general statements that you could make about what makes for a good mesosystem. Okay? Is that better? I think so. So we're okay. Good. Thank you. Okay, I want to talk about dating. Topic of interest to some of you. And we'll get to cohabitation. Maybe we'll get to engagement. There comes a point in life, sometimes kind of fun. We have 3 weddings to go to this summer. And it's fun. So I'm watching the family stress around one wedding in the family and one wedding among friends, and actually 2 weddings. One family is experiencing 2 weddings. They have 3 sons. 2 of them are getting married this summer. I'm glad I'm not doing that one. And we have one in the family. It's fun to watch. So we'll get to weddings eventually. But dating. Let's see. This is what I'd like to do. In the interest of being able to apply Bronfenbrenner to everything in life, and particularly to families, we need to start somehow getting these individual people together so that they can figure out whether or not they want to create a household, perhaps begin a family or merge the 2 families that they're parts of. And so we've got to get them thinking about how to get together. We've already talked about the characteristics of relationships that you think are important and the problems that come up in relationships. So what I'd like to do is take off from there and look at what is happening developmentally to see if we can take all of the romance out of dating. I think we can get rid of all of it. We'll try. I'm going to make dating so dull that you'll put it off for the next 5 years. We'll try. Okay. So let's apply Bronfenbrenner to dating. 2 people meet across a crowded room some enchanted evening, and they look at each other. They make eye contact. This is really important for humans. We make eye contact. We flirt a little bit. The pupils widen. And the gaze continues longer. And then they try to figure out how the hell are they going to get in bed with each other. Yeah. Or is this a person that you'd want to get in bed with and have a family with and spend Christmas Eve with and those sorts of things. So what are the proximal processes involved as they're doing that? The first is that they're going to engage in communication and exchange. They're going to be looking at the views of the world that they come into the relationship with. So that's what we do. We meet people, we find out a bit about who they are, we ask, we get to know them. Where are you from? What's your major? What year are you? Do you have a girlfriend, boyfriend? Are you available? Are you interested? Will you sleep with me tonight? No. We get those worldview things out on the table as quickly as we can. Some of you have probably engaged in speed dating, which makes the process very uniform. Have any of you done speed dating? No, I guess you're not singles yet. You're not old enough. Speed dating is a process where there is a system established for letting people get to know each other in the important way, in some of the important ways, very quickly. So you pay your $10, you go down to the wine, what's it called? No. I thought that's how you met Brian. Anyway, you go down to, what's it called? The wine down.
Wine room.
The wine room. Yeah. So, you know, they do it. You go down, you pay your money, you get a glass of wine, you get a number, and there are many versions of this, but essentially you spend 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, depending on how the game is played, talking to somebody. And you have a number and you have a sheet of paper. And after the 5 minutes, you're given two or three suggestions about what you ought to be sharing. Name, address, not address, not phone number, not last name, you know, major, year, that sort of stuff. And you get to talk to the person in a systematic way for as many minutes as the rules allow. A bell rings and you move on. Before you move on, you put down on your sheet of paper whether or not you're interested in any further conversation with this person at all. And both people are doing that. And then you go through. So across the hour or so, you get 7 or 8, 10, maybe 2 hours. You get a couple of glasses of wine. You don't have to drink, but you know, it sort of helps loosen people up. And then at the end of the evening, everybody has this rating form, which they give to the organizer, who then lets people know if they are both interested in further contact with each other, and the organizer sets those up. So the rest of the evening, then, whatever's left, can be devoted to people who actually are attracted to each other in some way and want to find out more. So it's a way to get to know a lot of people without spending a lot of money and seeing who's out there and discovering that you spent $10, 2 hours, a lot of psychological energy, and nobody in the room wants to spend any more time with you. That's not from personal experience, but that's what happens. So you're exchanging your views of the world. You're getting to know something, whether it's speed dating or over coffee or on the bus or on an airplane or waiting for the streetcar, whatever it is. You're exchanging world views with each other. You're finding out how the other person views the world, and you're going to be talking about interests and molar activities, and maybe inviting each other to share in molar activities so they become joint activities. You're going to be talking about your developmental trajectory. This may be taking you weeks or months of getting to know the other person. If you think about the conversations that you have with the people that you're interested in, that you spend time with, you're sharing this kind of information. You're asking about primary dyads that you've been in. You're asking about parents. You're finding out about the relationships that the person is involved in. You find out if the person went to another culture in high school or has lived someplace else. People are telling each other the important things they think are important in their lives. So you're getting the developmental history for the person. And as you're doing that, the important questions in this relationship are, is this person a good listener? Is this person willing to tell me about her past or his past? Is this a situation where one person tells about everything in his or her life and the other person is not revealing anything? If that's the case, the relationship is not likely to go very far. What's the affect? Do you enjoy this? Or do you have fun? Do you laugh? Do you share enough of the views with each other that you can laugh about the experiences that you've had? You can tell somebody a funny thing that happened to you and the person says, I don't think that's very funny. Or, yeah, I could never stand somebody who came from a family who did things like that. Right? You find out what the affect is, and you also get a sense of power. What is the person telling you about his or her experiences? Is the person gloating about having had a great deal of power over somebody they used to date? Or are you getting the feeling that this person doesn't consider power very much, or is unaware of his or her own power? Or are you getting a sense in the conversation that this person feels pretty powerless and is willing to go in the conversation and in activities however you want them to go, and they don't really have any objections to anything, but they also may not have any initiative, and you may be running the show. So you're assessing, as you do this, the characteristics of the potential relationship that you might develop. And at any point in that process, you're deciding, is this a person I can feel good about? Is this a person who makes me feel comfortable? Is this a person that I can have an exchange with that makes me hopeful that this person might become a friend? Again, that process might take a very short period of time. It might take a very long period of time. It depends on the nature of the opportunity and the interest that both people have and the skills that they have for sharing information with each other. If you hang out enough, then you're entering each other's ecosystems. So you go from Cook Commons, which might be a shared setting over coffee, to entering over time as you engage in joint activities with each other. You're entering each other's ecosystems. What is this person's ecosystem like? Is this person's primary settings a bar, a fraternity, parties, athletics? Where are the settings in this person's ecosystem? So you're assessing what that person's settings look like. You're becoming gradually transcontextual. Let's hang out at my room. Let's go to my apartment. I'm going to a party. Do you want to go with me? Do we like going to movies? What are the settings that are important to us? Do you want to come home and spend a week with my parents? Those sorts of invitations to share settings that are familiar to one or the other. It's unlikely, unless you grew up in the same neighborhood, it's unlikely that people who are meeting each other and getting to know each other will have a great part of their ecosystem shared. So you're moving into each other's ecosystem and checking out those settings. You're testing to see if other dyadic relationships that each of you are involved in will be supportive. What happens if you take this person home for dinner with your grandparents? What happens if I go hang out for the afternoon with this person's friends? They will be doing the same thing of trying to get to know a little bit about me, and they will be deciding whether they think the dyad that we're creating is going to be good for the person that they have a primary dyadic relationship with. So they'll be assessing whether it's likely to be supportive of their persons, their friends, their daughters, their husbands, and no, you don't want to do that with husbands, their cousins. I don't know how I started that sentence, so I don't know what the last word is, but you got the idea, okay? You're figuring out whether the other dyadic relationships are going to be supportive or not. So you take person home, person gets into a fight with your grandparents, turns out to be an idiot, and you end the relationship. It's fun sometimes to anticipate. I got to watch a wonderful experience last year. My stepdaughter was going to join us and my wife's parents for dinner, and she wanted to bring her new partner. And we had just met him, and the question was whether he would go to this event. He agreed. He was actually quite interested in going. And I had learned enough about him when we had dinner with him. I like him. He's a really nice guy. And I had learned that he had lived abroad for 6 months and worked. It may have been 9 months. Anyway, he was in another country. And it was a country where, in fact, my father-in-law has lived and traveled extensively. And I figured, okay, knowing that, they have both been in the same country, for an extended period of time and work, there is at least the hope of a comfortable conversation. And if a young woman is going to introduce a new boyfriend to her grandparents, there better be some way to connect. And it was absolutely fascinating to watch him at dinner with the grandparents, because they had an absolutely wonderful time. They knew the same places, they had been in the same towns, they had ridden the same buses, they were talking about the parks that they had been to, the hiking trails they'd been on, and the jobs that each of them had been doing there, and they went yakety 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 yak for about an hour. They were sitting at one end of the table, all three of them, the grandparents and Scott, and the rest of us were doing our own thing. And they ended up, of course, thinking that he was absolutely fabulous, he was a wonderful guy, and vice versa. And I was watching all of them and particularly impressed with this young man's ability to hold a conversation as a human being, sharing his own experience, but also asking them really good questions. He had the skill and the interest in getting to know their experience in the country where they had lived. So he was participating, he was completely reciprocal for both of them, and I thought, yes, this guy is scoring points like crazy with all of us because of his ability to engage in that process. Okay, so he now gets invited to family events by everybody, and if they break up, I don't know which one will be invited, we may give up on one of them. Are those microsystems in the other person's ecosystem comfortable? Can you go to the other person's house? Can you go to the other person's friends' houses? Can you go to the other person's family's house and be comfortable there? How do you move into that microsystem? Are the roles and the relationships and the activities and the pattern of those comfortable for you? Or do they do things in ways that you don't understand or that aren't comfortable for you? What kind of role do they create for you in that microsystem? What happens when you go to dinner with a potential partner's or a new partner's family? Are you expected to clear the table because you're female? Everybody sits there and says, wait a minute, it's time to clear the table. Or do they treat you like a royal guest? Does everybody wait on you and dote on you and make sure you have everything that you need and that you're really comfortable? When you walk in the door, does anybody greet you and say hi and wonder who you are? I was talking to a student in this class about 3 years ago who had the experience of going to her boyfriend's family's house, and she wondered what the relationship might be like because if it continued, because what happened was she came in, nobody knew she was coming. Nobody greeted her. Her boyfriend walked her through the kitchen and she said hi to the mother and said hi, and the mother talked to the son briefly and didn't say hi to the girlfriend, and they went on. And the father was watching television, and he said hi, and that was it. And they went on through the house and out on the deck and back and hung out together. And when it was dinner time, they got called, and they sat down at the table. And she said it was essentially as if she wasn't there. Her boyfriend talked to her, but neither of his parents asked her any questions or addressed any comments to her. She said it was the absolutely most uncomfortable dinner she had ever been through in her life. And she tried to elicit conversation or to join the conversation. She says, just fascinating, because it was as if she wasn't there. And after dinner, she voluntarily offered to help with the dishes. And they said, no, not necessary. Didn't thank her for the offer, didn't include her anyway, and so after dinner she and her boyfriend left. Can you imagine? Well, some of you have families that are like that, so you don't take your boyfriend's or girlfriend's home, right? You don't want them to know what your family is like. Can you hang out with your new partner's or potential partner's friends? Do they do things that you're interested in? Do they involve you? How does the partner introduce you to those settings? And how does the partner introduce you in those settings? Does the partner have a sense of what you need in the way of information? And does the partner introduce you or not? Does the partner let you take care of yourself in that microsystem without providing any of the support that you might need? What's the affect? How do you feel? Are you anxious? Do you feel depressed when you leave or while you're in the partner's settings? Is it fun? What, how do you fit? What's your affect and what's other people's affect in those settings? Are they ones that you'd want to continue? What are the roles? It's really fun sometimes to hang out with somebody, get to know them fairly well, and then go visit their families and have them be completely different within their family and treat you differently in that setting. Different microsystems bring out different roles and different ways of being for people. And if you're used to a person that you're connected to being friendly, outgoing, supportive, whatever it is, then to watch the person change in another microsystem might give you at least food for a conversation about what he or she feels at home. You fall back into letting mom take care of you? Do you get into arguments with your parents when your partner is there? Do you ignore your partner? Some of you have that experience of, as long as it's the two of you, you're fine. But when you go into any other setting where your partner's friends are or partner's families are, they get into their own thing and you get ignored. How does that make you feel? And especially if it lasts over a period of time, do you just get ignored in those settings or not? How does the other relate? You really want to know how a potential partner relates to the parent of the other sex. You want to see how the parents relate to each other. One of my favorites is watching potential partners relate to babies and children. Are you interested? Are you not? Are you comfortable? Are you... No. What happens when you get into a situation where somebody needs something or where somebody's upset? How does the partner relate in those situations? Thoughts or experiences about those? Going into the other settings of your partner, taking your partner into your settings? Yeah, none of you date. Okay, no. We'll go on. Invite your stories. Your dad's pretty intimidating?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we often get nervous going into, anxious going into family settings particularly.
Yeah, well, I came with my little brother, so they're
But isn't it interesting how the anxiety can build up as you anticipate all the stupid, uncomfortable, disturbing things that your parents might do? It's a very interesting process, and it makes sense, particularly if you think about the fact that it's not just the partner going into your setting, it's the people in that setting also trying to figure out how to modify the pattern to incorporate this new person who has a relationship. If you're talking about family, particularly parents, you're talking about a person who has a relationship with their child. And that has tremendous significance for them. And parents who are doing it for the first time in a serious relationship may be very anxious about it themselves. So you're looking at whether or not the other dyads are supportive of this partnership dyad. You're also looking at the parents' concerns about being evaluated. So it's not that parents are always in charge and they're making everybody else uncomfortable. It's that they know that you're going to evaluate them in that situation. And it may be an unprecedented situation for them. It may be an uncomfortable situation for them to have somebody from a quite different ecosystem come into their home. They want to know if the person is going to be comfortable. And they may get very anxious about that. And that difficulty of being comfortable with a best friend or a family member, that difficulty of everybody being comfortable with each other, is often a source of conflict in a developing relationship. And people break up because they end up realizing that it's not going to work. And they're not willing to give up their best friend, or they can't give up their parents and discover that their partner is not really comfortable in those settings, in those relationships.
My ex-boyfriend is my brother's old college roommate. He is like really good friends with my entire family, and my grandparents are more in love with him than I ever was. So when I went home the past day, my family had invited him to a family dinner without telling me.
Yep. Yep. I have a friend who is divorced, and her parents, in the interest of supporting their grandchild, her parents invited her ex for Christmas dinner because they knew the grandson would like to have his father there. Which is okay. I've known families that can do that very well. But this is a relatively new and not very comfortable divorce. And they didn't ask their daughter. So she found out the day before Christmas that the ex was coming to Christmas dinner. Christmas dinner in their family is a very old and elaborate tradition. And it's pretty much the highlight of the year for this extended family. She didn't go. She was so uncomfortable with the idea that she went in the morning before he got there, and then she didn't stay. And her parents were very miffed about this. And she said, "Well, I'm a little miffed that you didn't ask me before you invited him." We've had to edit that a little bit. Okay. So you can understand then what the potential discomforts are and the importance of those. And the process that people are going through is figuring out whether or not you can fit into new dyadic relationships with the dyads that your partner is in, either family or friends. You can figure out why it's potentially anxiety-producing for some people to move into some new microsystems. And you can also then think about what you would need to do to help a partner understand the microsystem in advance. This is a new setting, creating a new mesosystem setting for your partner. It would help if you got there with the person, transcontextual dyad. It would help if the person had valid and useful information about the setting. Who are the people who are going to be there? How are they related to me? Let's look at photographs. If this is a really important set of relationships for you to figure out, let's do the homework in advance and figure out who these people are, let you get familiar with them so that you're not struggling for the first 2 hours just to figure out what the names are and who they might be attached to. There will be a quiz after. Can you prepare your parents? Yes, Mom, he's vegan. It's very important that we have something that doesn't have beef in it, or all of the other things that vegans don't eat. Some of you have been in situations where you will go into somebody else's setting and you're happy that you brought your own granola bar because there isn't anything in the house that you can eat. Right. Yeah. Hey, 8-10 shots of vodka, no problem. On an empty stomach, right? Do this before dinner, right? No problem. And if that's going to characterize every dinner, you want to figure out how do you do it? Well, you can wear a turtleneck someplace to put the vodka instead of in your stomach. All right, let's move on. Engaging in joint activities. You're going to create a relationship here. Are those molar activities? Do they become more complex? Are they ones that you're really interested in? And over the long run, are there things that you're going to be interested in as activities, not just because the other person is there? Early on, many of us in a dating relationship will engage in lots of activities that we're really not particularly interested in and wouldn't take the initiative to start on our own. But because the other person is there and we're fascinated by the other person, we want to be with the other person and it's important to him or her, then we do them. And that's okay. But there comes a point in many of those relationships where you really can't go bowling again. Especially on the night when you'd really rather prefer, anyway, to listen to your favorite radio show. Radio, remember radio? No, okay. You probably don't. But the staying power of those molar activities is an important issue. Is this something that I'm going to want to do? Or after a while, am I going to say, no, why don't you go ahead? I'd rather do something else. That may become a point of conflict in the relationship if they're not going to be joint activities anymore. And it's helpful to learn those things early on before you get too deeply committed, because after you're in a committed relationship, married, civil union particularly, then it's an occasion of betrayal to decide that you really don't want to continue doing something that has always been important to the other person. And it's very easy to understand why a person would feel resentment and a sense of betrayal if all of your relationship you've been kind of faking it with this activity that you really don't particularly enjoy, and now that you're safely married or safely committed in the relationship, you don't want to continue it. And the other person is saying, huh, now what? I want to spend time with you, and we've been spending it doing this joint activity, and you don't want to do that anymore. If I want to continue it, then I have to do it without you. We are about to have a major disagreement and a conflict because of that. So it's best early on to engage in the activities enough to know whether these are things that you're actually going to be interested in over the long term. That means knowing yourself, doing the exploration, and before you get too far into the relationship, figuring out if you need to discuss this at greater length. It's also helpful to think about the variety of activities that you engage in and whether that's going to increase. Is this person open to new activities? Or has this person been doing the same thing for 5 years and never does anything new and resists when I say, you know, maybe we could go camping this summer? Nah, I don't like the mosquitoes. And the person wants to continue doing exactly what he or she has been doing and is not interested in exploring new things. Is this going to become more diverse? Are these going to become more complex? Or is devoting your life entirely to professional baseball as a spectator it? Is that all you've got? And you get through the winter season by watching videos of last season until spring training starts. That's not going to make the relationship rich. Enough said. Are you giving up activities that are important to you because the other person doesn't want to spend time in them? When will you start resenting that? In the interest of having a relationship, you may give them up and consider that to be temporary, and then discover when you want to go back to them and have better balance, then you're resented again because you're doing something that wasn't part of the relationship early on. We'll go back to the relationship. As the relationship continues, you're constantly, at least implicitly, assessing the power and affect and reciprocity in the relationship. As disagreements come up, as differences are identified, how do you resolve those? When you want to do different things, how do you resolve them? How do you resolve them under different conditions? Can you have a wonderful discussion of something when the two of you are alone, But when you add friends in it, it falls apart. Can you have a wonderful discussion when you're with your family but not hers? Do arguments happen in one setting rather than the other? Is it a competitive relationship? Can you collaborate? Are you teaching each other? Can you teach each other? Are you permitted to know something the other person doesn't know? Or are you relating with a typical guy who knows everything? Well, I knew that. I know how to do that. And certainly isn't going to let you teach him about technology or suggest that he do something different while he's driving. Can you teach each other about sex if you're into the relationship far enough to get to that point, like married, right? Can you teach each other about sexuality? Can you discuss relationships? Is it okay to have different opinions? How do you deal with pleasure? Can you be happy? Or when you're happy and excited about something, do you get cold water thrown by the partner who's perhaps envious of your accomplishment or your fun? How do you deal with stress? Can you talk about it? Do you admit that you're stressed? I asked an acquaintance a couple of weeks ago how her husband was dealing with a very stressful situation that we all knew he was in. And her response was, he never gets stressed. Talk to him about it. Yeah, okay. Watching him, he was a real stress case. But they weren't going to admit it to anybody, including each other, I think. But talking about him and talking with him and watching him over the course of an hour or two, he was experiencing a lot of stress. When one of you is stressed, how does the other one respond? Can you help reduce the stress, or do you increase it for each other? Can you back off when the other person is stressed about something and let them deal with it? How do you deal with illness? This is one of Uncle Larry's pieces of advice. I have a number of pieces of advice from my vast experience of dating. You can laugh. Okay. One of the pieces of advice is that you probably should not make a commitment to anybody who has not spent time with you when you have the flu. And you probably want to know how the other person behaves when he or she has the flu. Okay. Why? Because some people have a great deal of difficulty being sick. And some people have a great deal of difficulty being with somebody who is sick. Most of us want, when we're sick, to be treated the way our mothers should have treated us. Fluff our pillows, chicken soup, flat ginger ale, whatever it takes, radio, music, whatever it was, all of our favorite things, our teddy bear. We want to be pampered, we want to be taken care of, but we don't want somebody in our face too much. And people differ in how much contact they want when they're sick. Some people would rather just, you know, leave me alone, come back in 3 or 4 days. I don't need you around, I just need to curl up in a fetal position and pull the covers over my head and sip orange juice for the next 3 days, leave me alone. That's fine. Can you do that if that's what the person wants? I dated a woman for a while who announced very early in our dating that she occasionally had times when she simply needed to curl up in a fetal position with the covers over her head and to be left alone. And if she canceled a date or announced that that's what she was going to do, I was not to take it personally. It was just the way she coped with whatever was going on in her life. And she said, I'll apologize if I do it and cancel something, but otherwise, don't get stressed out about it. I'll just do it. It's the way I do things. And she did. And it was fine. I worried about her, but I could leave her alone. I didn't marry her. That's right. She wouldn't have married me anyway. I was too dull. Anyway, how do you like to be treated when you have the flu? How do you want to be treated? Can the two of you be sick together?
Who was too dull? You were her.
I was too dull.
You're not dull.
Thank you. As long as I can lecture. But, I don't want to get too personal about that, but in class, it's okay. Interesting things to say. But being lectured at for 30 or 40 years in a marriage, that's probably not okay. My kids are very good about pointing out when I'm professoring. My son is very careful sometimes to very gently point out, Dad, and after a few times I respond and he says, I'm not registered for this course. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll put away my notes, put away my laser pointer, and now we can have a conversation. You know, what we ought to do sometime, make a note, how to ask my first wife to do a discussion with you. No, we probably don't want to do that. We won't do that. Where are we? Illness. Whew. Okay. How does the person behave with friends and family? We've already talked about that. You are learning about the other person. And part of the question is this a person that you're comfortable with? Is this a person that you can respect? Is this a person who respects you? You are engaged in a process of getting a differentiated and valid view of the other person. And that means finding out as much as you can about the way the person relates, the person's developmental trajectory, the person's ecosystem, what kind of microsystem the person is comfortable in, how he or she behaves differently, and how he or she is going to relate in different situations, stress, illness, happiness, foreign cities. What happens when you travel with each other? Some of us get very anxious as we travel and move into unknown places, unfamiliar places, and we don't deal with that well. Other people are just wonderful about that and like to go into new settings and take people with them. You need to know that about the other person eventually. You're learning also about yourself, and that's one of the most important consequences of creating relationships with other people. Not just learning about them, but figuring out who you are in a relationship with that person. What are you learning about yourself? What kinds of skills are you adding? What kind of communication improvements are you making? How are you getting better at explaining yourself or dealing with stress? Are you doing that? One of the things that's helpful in that is to keep a relationship journal. Write about your experience, both of your partner, of yourself, and the relationship. What do you like? What's comfortable? What do you not like? You don't have to do a formal developmental analysis of it, though of course we recommend that. But keeping track of what's going on over time. You are creating a shared mesosystem. if you are dating a person long enough, you are creating a shared mesosystem. Settings that you share, that you're both in together, and eventually a developmental trajectory. What settings do you go into together, and what activities do you engage in those settings, and how do they connect to the next setting that you go into together? Do you eventually build up a history that includes activities that are becoming important to you and more complex and that have some momentum with this other person? That's what it takes to create the intimacy that Erickson talks about in his theory, a shared history. And you're creating a developmental trajectory. If you don't go into different settings and you don't engage in molar activities with each other over time, you're not doing that. And if you're not doing that, you're not creating couplehood. How do you deal with ecological transitions? What happens when one of you changes? What happens when one of you moves out of the residence hall into an apartment and the other one doesn't? What happens when one of you goes through getting a new job, leaving college, going into a new setting? How does the couple respond to that? Are you expecting things to stay exactly the way they were, when in fact the other person's role and activities and mesosystem may have changed? You can't. You have to change with the person and do that comfortably, and if you don't, then the relationship is going to experience conflict around that. Is it truly a developmental dyad? Is the dyadic relationship that you're developing with this other person helping each of you become more mature? Are you developing more molar activities that you can do on your own? Are you taking more initiative in the relationship? Are you creating activities together? Are you getting a more valid view of yourself and the other person and the world? Are you learning anything? If you're not, do you want to continue it? Does most of that make sense in some way? We're going to convert this into a computer program, checklist and analysis of your dating relationships that will lead to suggestions for breaking up or continuing and improving it. You can do that with this. Okay, let's assume that the relationship continues and it gets pretty comfortable and you really like each other and you need a place to live this summer. So let's talk about what happens to the settings that you go into as a couple. In the first place, you're visiting. You visit each other's settings. Sometimes it takes a long time to get into the other person's settings. This should be a red flag. The person doesn't want you to see his apartment or his room, doesn't want you to meet his family. Let's keep this just the two of us. That's okay. And focus on each other and the relationship, but eventually, if you're going to get a more differentiated and valid view, you have to get into the other person's ecosystem. And then sometimes people occasionally share. They spend the night with each other, they go on vacation together, they take a road trip together. And then then comes the big decision. Are we going to live together for the summer, for next year, for the rest of our lives? Cohabiting. Are we going to move in together and share a setting? It's a huge ecological transition. A huge ecological transition. You are deciding to share a setting. You get to choose that setting. And each of these steps is an opportunity for creating a developmental trajectory together as a couple or for conflict. When you decide to move in together and have a setting, then you are creating a microsystem in that setting, a pattern of roles, relationships, and activities. Cohabitating has an irrelevant syllable in it. It's like one of those orientating words. You orient. You don't need to orientate. You go to orientation or you engage in cohabitation. That extra syllable is important in creating the noun, but in the verb it's unnecessary. So you're cohabiting, and in doing that you're cohabitants or cohabitators. French fried cohabitators, perhaps. No, I don't want to go that way. You're creating the role, creating the relationships and the activities. And here's where Bronfenbrenner becomes really important. Every setting has a microsystem in it. And the physical characteristics, proposition F, determine what is possible and how that microsystem is likely to be established. But each person is also taking into it his or her expectations for that microsystem. Where do you bring your expectations from? Where do those expectations come from? What do you think of the role of the other person? What do you expect your role to be? And when you create that microsystem together, and it is a collaborative effort, you get to sort out what your expectations are. You get to discuss the expectations. Ideally, you sort those expectations out in advance, before you ever make this decision to cohabit. And when the conflicts arise, and they will, you have a means for talking about them. And you have a commitment to talking about them. Because this is going to be a grand experiment with this other person. An unprecedented experiment for this particular couple. You may have done it before with somebody else, and it may have been a disaster, or it may have been wonderful. That's helped create expectations for you that you can share before you go into it. What sorts of issues come up in thinking about that microsystem? Daily rhythms. Getting up in the morning or not. Getting up at noon or at 2, whatever it is. Going to bed at night. Each of you has a rhythm, and when you get into a setting together, you get to figure out how to do that. Some people have diurnal rhythms, biological patterns that are flexible, and other people don't. There is actually a genetic characteristic. It's been studied in an extended family in Vermont. It's called the early riser gene. There are people who can't sleep past 5 or 6 in the morning. And they fade about 9 o'clock at night. And they're interesting people. You go to parties and they disappear. Yes? There is a genetic load for that. It's been identified in families, in extended families. You can see the people who have it and the people who don't within the family, and it's a fairly clear genetic pattern. Yeah. And people have been complaining about you for years.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's helpful to know, and the geneticist here wrote a paper about it about 5 years ago, about this family in Vermont. That paper has been cited all over the country because there is a tendency for people who have this early rising gene to be considered odd. I watched one family, and before I knew about this, I watched one family in which the parents were married for, well, and they're still married, probably been 60 years. They're both in their 80s. And all through their marriage, one of the dissatisfactions that the father had and expressed in a sometimes not too supportive way was his sense that there was something wrong with his wife because she went to bed at 9 o'clock. She went to sleep at 9 o'clock, wherever she was. And he expected his wife to stay up with him until 11 or 12, because those were really good hours for him. You know, from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock were high energy hours for him, and he wanted to have sex and he wanted to do things, and he would wake her up, or try to, and then she would be up at 5 and baking bread and doing all those wonderful things. And what I saw happening in the family was that his criticism of his wife because of her need for sleep, he said she needs too much sleep because she has to go to bed at 9, low energy level. She actually was a very high energy person, but that's not his view. What I saw was that their kids were exposed to their father's disrespect for their mother through their entire lives. And they modeled that, they copied that. And they copied it in their relationship with her in subtle ways. And then they copied it in their relationships with their own spouses. The three sons all had what I would consider subtle disrespect for their wives. And a couple of family members were trying to figure out where that came from, but it was their father, who was otherwise a really nice guy. Let's see, all three sons are divorced now. Yeah. If you're going to pick a wife to be disrespectful to, pick somebody who doesn't mind over the long run. Okay, one more minute. Daily rhythms. Maintenance. Who does things? Who cleans? There's a fascinating thing that happens when couples get together, particularly heterosexual couples, because most of us have grown up in some way in a situation where men and women have different activities and different views of the world. And when you put us together, some people are more domestic than others. And what happens in the cohabiting situation is that you get to see those expectations for the traditional gender roles coming out. Even if a couple think they're really enlightened and really non-sexist and non-traditional, it's very interesting to watch people slide slowly or not so slowly into traditional male-female roles where she does all the housework and he watches television. We'll pick up from there on Monday.
Or taking me in.
Actually, let's see how many people are going to.
Okay. Just because I have class that starts at 3:30. So yeah, I don't know.
You'll have time.
Hi.
I forgot to announce and remind you that there is a retake for the eco-exam. If you need to take it for the second time, now is a time to do that.
I was a paramedic. Did we get that data to
the
group?
It
should be out in like 20 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably Monday.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't take too long, I don't think.
Nah, it won't take you long.
And then we'll go to Jane.
She's going to ace it.
But no, my car's at the dorm, so if you want to pick me up, oh, but I have keys. Yeah, I'll just do that.
Oh, that's all right. As long as you're enrolled in it. Actually, the registrar's computer probably doesn't even pay any attention to what you're enrolled in or whether you have the prerequisite.
Yeah.
I get to enforce that later. So, and there shouldn't be any problem with room. Good.
Yep.
If you're taking the retake, settle down toward the front, and we'll start right away if you want to. If you need to go potty, go potty.
Okay.
Hi.
If I want to do a late withdrawal, how do I go about doing that?
You'll have to talk to the instructor first.
Right.
I got your email,
yeah.
Your second one about
yeah.
that. Is there a reasonable excuse?
Well, yeah, I was sick, and then I went home early, and I missed like some classes, and like I think if she understands that I can, she like agrees.
Yeah. Did you go to the doctor, or go to the counseling center, or anything?
I went to the counseling center.
Okay. If it really helps if you can get the person that you saw there to recommend that you be permitted to withdraw.
Okay.
So. Would you?
So I can go and talk. And what about my access? Can I talk to my
yeah.
and she could like,
yeah.
that access?
Yeah. Between them, they should be able to put enough together.
Okay.
And then the instructor has to okay it, and I have to okay it.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Thank you.
You want that? No? Not yet?
Not yet.
You're welcome.
I'm going to the office to take it on Friday.
Yeah, what time?
Anytime that's good for you.
Friday.
It's not really morning person.
Late riser gene.
Yeah. I was thinking that.
Yeah.
My whole family.
1 o'clock?
Sounds good. Okay, thanks.
Your name is?
Laura.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to come and meet her with me on Friday, right?
Okay.
She's coming.
She doesn't have to. It's no problem. Do you want to keep in case somebody else shows up? They won't take long.
Yeah.
Just call me and I'll be ready to come over.
Ha ha.